Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply. Actually, the early Model T, it actually had a clomp clomp. You know, they just clomp clomp.
Ah, you stole my joke. I was going to get there. No, but
this episode of the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs is presented by Hankook Tire and their EV exclusive Ion Tire lineup. This summer, Hankook is the sponsor of the Demo Days Festival, where you can test drive cars ranging from EVs, hybrids, and even ICE cars as part of North America's leading EV and electric mobility event. Go to demodaysfestival.com to find out about upcoming Demo Days festivals near you. And stay tuned to Inside EVs for exciting content presented by Hankook Ion. All right, back to the show. Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In podcast, a weekly news show from Inside EVs all about the future of transportation. I'm Tim Levin.
And I'm Mac Hogan.
On this week's show, we are answering your EV questions. We got a lot of great feedback the last time we did this, so we figured we would run it back. As always, if you have questions you'd want us to answer on the show, drop us a comment on YouTube or shoot us an email at podcast@insideevs.com. Shall we? Shall we, Mac?
Let's do it.
So this is one question that we didn't actually specifically get, but this is the top question I get all the time when people learn what I do for a living. Probably same thing with you, is like a version of the same question. What's the best EV you've ever tested? What's your favorite EV you've ever tested? And relatedly, if you could buy an EV, money no object, what would it be? So I'll let you go first and then I'll give my answer.
I know my answer is a Rivian, and it kind of always has been. I like going off-road, I like adventuring, I like camping, and I would prefer for that to be electric, so they have me in their sights, as I put in my R2 review. Challenge is, like, which one? Because there's three, right? There's the R1S, R1T, and then now the R2. Historically, I've thought the R1T has always been the best looking, best to drive, especially in the Gen 1 models, like, rode way better. The R1T or R1S was a little bit sloppy. But my favorite thing with big SUVs is being able to sleep in them when you go camping, and especially in a big EV with a big battery, you can then keep the climate control running, and it's, like, awesome. It unlocks so many other opportunities. So I would always say R1S. But these days, I think I would go R2 above all of them, an R2 performance, because I don't like hyper complicated or giant vehicles. I don't really want my car to weigh 7,000 pounds when it's primarily just driving around town. The R2 is plenty fast enough. I think it looks just as good. I think the interior is just as good, and it's got that drop down rear window. Plenty of range, some upgrades that the R1 does not have. So I think I would go with that, honestly, R2.
Nice. Yeah, we'll see if my answer changes maybe once I drive that. But generally, Rivian has also been my answer to that question, at least one of my answers. When I think, like, probably an unhealthy amount about what would happen if I, like, won the Powerball, and I think about what car would I buy. Well, it's like, what house would I buy? Then what car would I buy? It is often probably R1T. Max pack, you know, 400 miles of range. It's like 90 grand is something that I would not buy myself, buy without the aid of the state lottery. And I don't, unlike you, I actually don't do that much like camping or outdoorsy stuff. I like to mountain bike, and I mainly like a lot of Rivian owners. I think I would like to look like I do those things.
Yes. It's important.
Like, I do it a little bit, but not enough to require like a Rivian. But I just think they're cool. They're so such cool. Well thought through cars.
And the colors.
The colors are good. The design is good. The UI is good. I probably wouldn't get, like, I would probably go for the dual max. I don't think I need tri-motor or quad-motor type performance, I think I'd rather take, like, that gives you a range hit. I feel like if I'm going like all out on an EV, I kind of want one that has over 400 miles of range rather than the one that goes 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds. You might be different.
Well, especially for exploring. I think it's interesting. I've never been that much of a quad evangelist because locking differentials are just better. The quads, when you're climbing up stuff, you'll always have the one of the wheels flare at speed, then have to be braked, and then it send power to the other thing. And it's not quite as... It kind of ends up feeling like a dual motor where you're relying on the traction control a ton. That being said, I would still maybe go for a try because I love the feeling of sliding a car. And I slid the R1T Gen 2 in the mud at Dirtfish up in Seattle at like a rally racing school thing. And it's really fun to slide a giant truck around. So if I was going to go R1, I would probably go for a try. I suppose there's no reason not to go for the quad. It's just like I don't even think the quad needs to exist. So I don't really want one in the same way. And the tri is already so fast that it's like absurd. But I would still, I think, go R2 because you plant your right foot in it. You can slide anything.
Yeah. The other one that I always bring up and one of the favorite cars I've ever tested is Porsche Taycan Cross Turismo, and specifically I had the Turbo S, which was like, I don't know what it is now, but at the time that was the top spec model. Yeah. Probably still is.
It was like 200 grand. There's a Turbo GT now.
A GT. Yeah. It was like $200,000, 0 to 60 in well under 3 seconds. It looks amazing. It has like kind of a little bit of space, like a little more space than a Taycan since it's the hatchback version. It's just such a cool car and you never see them. Like I've seen like one in the flesh. The problem is it doesn't have a lot of like room, you know, like the back seats are kind of heinous and the trunk space is not very good. But if I just won like 200 mil, I think I might have another couple of cars around.
Yeah, it's interesting. I also really like a Taycan, but I drove I think it was a 4S. It was one of the less powerful ones. And I like a Turbo S. I haven't driven the Turbo GT, but I'm sure I would like it. But they're so fast, it just scares me. And like, like driving. My favorite thing is driving a car hard, like taking it towards the edge of its capability. And in a Turbo S, I just chicken out way before the car is anywhere near its limit. So the like lower power Taycans, I find really, really fun because they're just as engaging, but you can actually put your foot down for more than 1 second without, you know, just like getting to step out of the car.
Blasting into
territory.
Hyper speed. Yeah.
So that's definitely on my list. As honestly would be one of like the big, I haven't driven a Cadillac Escalade IQ, but when I had the Vistiq, just like a big 600 horsepower luxury barge with Super Cruise hit me pretty hard. Like I really liked that experience of like Dolby Atmos sound, sitting in a giant comfy massage chair, listening to really like awesome stereo, really comfortable suspension. So some big American barge also has some appeal to me, even though again, do I need a 9,000 pound Escalade? Probably not, but we're not talking about what we need. We're talking about what, you know, what we would do with more money than anyone needs.
Yeah. Well, Patrick called it the America's finest vehicle. So I think he might have had a point. Yeah. The other ones, I'll give like honorable mention, I think, to Lucid Air. Like Lucid Air is, as Jason Fenske was talking about recently on the podcast, like he had his own issues with it, but he was also like, it is the best riding car I've ever driven. The packaging and the engineering behind it is so good. When they work, they are really, really magnificent vehicles, I think.
And they look great. The one that would potentially also be on my list that I haven't driven, but you had, and I'm surprised that it didn't come up also as an honorable mention, would iX3 make it to your list or not quite?
The iX3 is a great car. For some reason, it doesn't hit me in the soul the way that like the rib, you know, I have a soft spot, especially for the startup cars, just because they're so different and so sort of new. You know, they have like the kind of more interesting software. The whole engineering of it is just that clean sheet sort of design. Like, I don't have any affinity for BMW or anything like that, but I do feel something for like a Rivian.
A lot of it is also vibes, as you've talked about. Where
it's vibes. It's just the vibes.
You could certainly do most of the mountain biking trips you've ever done with a iX3 with a hitch carrier or something. But when you picture that, it's you picture, oh, I'm in a Rivian. I'm like, I look like this cool outdoorsy person. And
front
I don't
wheel
think...
hanging out the back of the bed, you know, that kind of thing.
And this is something I wrote about in my CLA review, which should be out the day before this podcast or maybe 2 days before. But that's always a problem I have reviewing modern Mercedes. When I started, before I ever got into the car industry, when I was young, Mercedes was like my favorite brand, because in my head, like a just a really well-built, like quiet luxury car that is not in your face. It's very respectable and thoughtful, and just everything you touch is really nice. That is what I want a Mercedes to be. And then you get in a modern Mercedes, and it's very glitz and light up badges, and they put the little Mercedes star everywhere, and the little AI lady tells you to take your phone out of the wireless charging pad, even though you've already taken it out of the wireless charging pad. There's just a lot of in your faceness to the luxury. And I think there is clearly by their sales that still works, and there's a huge audience for that type of luxury, but it does not hit me. And that's where it's hard to sometimes review these cars, because so much of it comes down to like, who are you personally? And I think maybe Rivian gets too much love from us because we're so directly the target demo of like coastal Californians that have outdoor activities and also likes good software. Like, we're right in the market.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's move on. That was interesting. This is next question. What's next for Tesla, the car company? And I think specifically the car company, like, we could go on and on about robotaxis and robots and all of that stuff. But fundamentally, like, for the core Tesla business, like, what are we looking at over the next few years for this company that once was, you know, in some ways still is, but really like kicked off the EV, you know, revolution.
For sure.
But now is like really kind of not as much of a big player.
Well,
I guess asterisk, because we'll talk about how they still are a big player, but go ahead.
They're still nearly half the market in the US. And I think for good reason. I think as I interviewed as part of a group, Rivian CEO RJ Scaringe, and he was talking about how little choice there is in the EV market for really compelling rounded products. And I really feel that every time I try to recommend an EV to someone, because most of them have sort of a big obvious asterisk. Now, I include Tesla in that because things about physical controls or the design of the interior may put you off. But when you look at it from a value perspective, it's really hard to challenge a Model Y when you look at what the feature set is, what the driving dynamics are like, how much more practical it is. I always talk about my Blazer EV weighs like 700-800 pounds more than a Model Y, is way bigger and has less space in the trunk, no frunk, not immediate. Like, it's just Tesla is an EV-only company, and you can tell that in everything they do. But I think the Model Y is a good place to focus this, because it's an old product at this point, right? It's been around for 5 years, but it's based on the Model 3, which has been around for almost 10 at this point. And it's hard for me to think about from a product standpoint what they should do, because there's been this reporting that there's a sub Model Y Tesla in the works, in theory. That's what we
originally... Smaller than a Model Y.
Right. What we originally thought ended up being the Model Y standard, which was just a decontented Model Y. I don't know if that would matter as much as I used to think it would. And this is something I've been cheering them on to build more affordable, smaller products for a while. But watching the Bolt, watching the Leaf, watching Kona EV, all of these things come and go, it just doesn't seem like Americans give a shit about sub Model Y sized cars. And that's not just, you look at like Honda CRV sales versus HRV sales, or Toyota Corolla Cross versus Toyota RAV4. We want the RAV4, Model Y, CRV. That's as small as we want our cars to get. And so I don't think that introducing a cheaper product would necessarily matter to the core of the business. And I think one thing they did innovate is that in the gas engine era, it seemed like having a bunch of different models and constantly tweaking them and updating them and changing them was a way to keep freshness alive. But what Tesla has sort of proven is that if you throw your entire weight behind one or two platforms, you can keep updating them incrementally with little things that keep making them better. I was watching an Out of Spec video recently about having one of the first Model S cars ever made. Mm. And it got a software update like a month ago and still has, it has route planning. It has all kinds of things that were not on the original one. There's hardware limited features they don't have. But anyway, I think I've started to see more companies seem to follow that approach when you look at how the Ford UEV platform is going to be highly common across the group, how Hyundai, it's more and more become just, no, we're going to focus on the IONIQ 5 rather than create all these other things. And in a world where scale matters so much, I wonder if the best thing they could possibly do is just throw more money at the Model Y and make it even better than it is. Because I don't see a huge amount of volume in the three-row space. I don't see a huge amount of volume in the sedan space. And I don't see a huge amount of volume sub-Model Y SUV space. So it's like, you can make a Model Y, you can make a slightly extended Model Y, but winning that customer, the RAV4 customer, with everything you got, seems like all they can do. So I don't know. I'm feeling a little less mystified by their product strategy than I was maybe a year ago. What do you think?
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, I think it's important to mention, like the backstory is Tesla has really let the lineup languish, right? Like the Model Y is old, the Model 3 is old. Both have gotten really good improvements that I think boosted their appeal more than I had expected. Like the sales of those cars, they've gone down as the rest of the US market has gone down. The whole, you know, all Tesla sales are down, but this is not a company that's seen its sales drop by 50%. You know, it's still sort of hanging in there. And if you look at the US, you know, it is hanging on better than other companies in this sort of EV downturn, which makes sense because other companies, they have gas cars, they're like shifting production toward gas cars, deprioritizing EVs. Tesla doesn't have that option, but it means that in Q4 and Q1, Tesla recaptured over 50% market share of EVs in the US after having its market share dwindle and dwindle and dwindle. So in relation to this market in the US, Tesla's still doing well, albeit in a market that is moving in the wrong direction, in a market that's shrinking. I do think that it needs more models still. Like, if Tesla wants to be the company that doesn't just sell 1.6 million cars a year, that sells 2 or 3 million cars a year, or, you know, back in the day, they had this crazy goal to sell 20 million, which I think anybody who was serious knew that that wasn't possible. It's like double Toyota. You would have to have, you know, a bunch of car companies go out of business for that to happen. But for the car business to move, you know, to grow, they just need more cars. And I think when you look at somebody like Toyota, they have the RAV4 space like Tesla is aiming for, but they have like seven other crossovers at different, you know, slightly different variations. Especially now when you have the Model Y making up overwhelming majority of sales. And now you don't even have a Model X. You don't even have a three row. I think there's a lot of opportunity for them to go for a slightly bigger, boxier car or a slightly more off-roady thing. You know, just something that looks different than the Model Y.
That is definitely, I think, there was another thing RJ was saying about there's just a natural maxim to what one product can do, right? Because some people like you and I,
and I think the Model Y is hitting that.
Right. Even though you and I could probably, I could camp in the Model Y and go down most of the dirt roads I do. It's just like clearly not designed with that as the primary goal, and you can push it. And I know there will be commenters talking about how they've driven theirs to the top of Mount Everest and all of that. But I think you're right that the best strategy would probably be variations on what exists. But that's why I brought up the scale point. Is one of the challenges is like, for Toyota, you can make all these different, you can make the Highlander and then you can make the 4Runner and you can do all these different things. But with the current EV economics, you're not just competing against other EVs, you're competing against gas cars. And a 4Runner body on frame, equally capable vehicle is not going, if it's electric, is not going to cost the same as the gas powered equivalent. And even if it did, it would have to overcome all of this resistance at the market. Trucks, same example, right? Like, you can make a truck that's electric. Can you make a truck that is going to usurp the F-150? We've had like six attempts at that. No. And so you're boxed in by economics right now. And part of why they have unlocked this crazy sales formula is that they keep it simple. There are very few colors. There are very few options. You know, it is,
yeah,
pick your flavor, pick one of two optional colors or three shades of gray or white or black. And that's it. And so I wonder, could they upgrade the business somehow by making a boxier version, by making a squared off version without also imposing a bunch of one-time costs and retooling and all of these other things that would then make it less price competitive? I think that would be a challenge, but ultimately it's one they're going to have to figure out eventually, because you can't just keep making the same products forever. And even adding what I think many of our nerdier readers would want in terms of 800 volt architectures or certain changes to that level of just keeping pace with the competition. Does going to an entirely 800 volt system and cutting your 10 to 80 time in half, how many more sales does that actually lead to?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And I just think like...
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I just think like bottom line, I think you said, like you said, it's going to be fundamentally hard to hang on with one product. And especially when you have all the, you know, iX3, GLC, R2, Lucid Cosmos to some extent, Porsche Cayenne, like they have made a car that sells a million units a year or more in an era when the competition was trying to catch up. And now there are just going to be so many more options that I think that they're going to have to, like you said, I just think they're going to to figure it out sooner or later.
I agree, but there is something to be said for you only make products when you know you can win with them. And I think one of the challenges, R2 is the only one that you mentioned that is actually number one that we know all the details of, and number two actually exists in the same price class. And even that is arguable because the cheap ones aren't out yet, but let's assume they come out. R2 is 400 volt, same basic range proposition, same attempt to push towards an FSD-like competitor, which isn't here yet. There is a branding reason that you and I would prefer an R2. There's maybe a stylistic, an interior reason, but there's no slam dunk, oh God, like this spec kills it, except for ground clearance, which again is part of the branding. And I don't think Tesla, even if they came out with a hardcore off-road version of, or hardcore, an R2 equivalent, would necessarily win with that, because that's not what their, it's not where their brand is authentic. And I think there is just a cap to how much Tesla can take up. And I don't know how much, I think a slightly tweaked Model Y, or maybe a something between a Model Y and a Model X, something in that like Blazer EV length, bigger SUV, but with Tesla style packaging, could get them a marginal gain. I just don't think, I mean, if this is what controls 50% of the EV market, I don't think that gets you to 60. I think that gets you to maybe keep 50 for another year. But I think they are betting this whole thing on autonomy being the killer app. And
yeah, of course.
At this point, they've committed to that for so long that I don't know. To the overall business, I don't think it's going to matter to Tesla whether they have another model. And I think, yeah, their new model is the Cybercab. And we got those EPA filings. We'll see if that ends up working out.
Yeah, totally. Let's move on to our third question. This is about EV range estimates. It's actually more of a comment that we're going to respond to. William Clark 6466 asks, or says, I totally agree that the prominent BEV range estimates should be for highway usage at the maximum posted interstate speed limit and state that speed, 85 miles per hour. Also, it should state range estimates for three temperatures, 32 degrees, 68 degrees, 104 degrees, so the potential user can have a broader understanding of the capabilities. This was, I remember we talked a little bit about this in a recent episode that he's responding to, which is like the problem with the EPA range estimate is that it is a combined number. It includes both, you know, it's this calculation that the car companies make, and it includes city and highway driving. And that's why some people, when they buy a new EV, they're surprised by when they set out for a road trip and they go 80 for a couple hours, they deplete most of their range when right. the thing was supposed to get 330, you know? So what do you think about this? How could we, if we were in charge,
yeah,
how would we revamp the EPA estimate?
First off, I think this is yet another example of what I talk about when I'm talking about so much of the EV challenge is not a tech challenge. It's we don't know how to best optimize for our tech, and we don't. Basic structures that you and I take for granted, like the EPA city highway combined rating on your gas car's window sticker, are the product of a lot of hard learnings. You know, that's not the first draft. And I think the first draft of the range figures made some sense. I think it was ever communicated well. I talked to so many experts who still don't really understand the testing procedure. Also, we were recently doing a story on some EPA range figures, and I was looking through the testing protocol and how they test it as a certain speed, but then there's an adjustment factor, which is just you take the max range that it actually delivered and times it by 0.7 to just sort of account for AC and real-world driving aggression yeah. and all this other stuff. And I think that when you're just kind of throwing a random factor at, I don't know, that is to me a sign that maybe we're not doing this in the most intuitive way. But I think it's probably not feasible to do this on a state-by-state level, as this commenter suggested, but I do think 70-mile-per-hour range test may be a little hard to sell in terms of so many states there is no legal 70-mile-per-hour limit, but like at the end of the day, that's what a good interstate pace is. I could see an argument for 65, but either way, we need a highway range figure. Does that trump the range figure for the combined or the city in a insane world where we can only do one number, even though we're going to do multiple types of tests? Like, yeah, I think highway should be the range figure because it's going to be better in the city. And also, you don't really care in the city because it's not going to be mileage that is the number one factor in the city. If you're driving 300 miles around New York City, it's going to be so much based on traffic and AC usage and your aggression and all that stuff. But I also think the other thing that he mentions, doing it at three different temperatures, I think I very rarely hear about people complaining too much about hot weather. I think yeah. a standard summertime or warm weather or normal temperature test and then a winter range test, I think both, having both on the sticker would be really helpful because if you live in a climate that gets severe winters, you know, I'm back home in Ohio right now, it's not just that you have to account for a big drop-off, but that different EVs handle that differently. There are a Chevy Bolt with no heat pump is like disastrous in the, you know, in the cold, but a lot of modern EVs are pretty good at scavenging a lot of heat. This may also, that gets into a whole separate question about people not realizing how important it is to precondition your EV before you leave the house so that you set off with a warm battery and you're not driving around on a cold battery. So you'd have to factor that into the testing procedures. But I do think highway and cold weather both need to factor in a major way. What do you think could help improve it?
Yeah, no, I think that's smart. I think both city and highway are important or like useful for people, right? Because mm-hmm. I think neither accurately captures, or I mean, the middle figure doesn't accurately capture right. Either one, right? I think people might see a rating of 250 miles or whatever it is on the Bolt, and maybe that doesn't feel like enough for people, yeah. even if they are city, primarily slow speed grocery getter drivers. And so we've seen in some of these extreme tests, you know, there was one that GM did not too long ago. I think it was with a Silverado EV. They went something like 1,000 miles on a charge. Yeah. And it's because they were going 20 something miles an hour and, mm-hmm. you know, optimizing in all these different ways. But I think the best case range, like the best case range and the worst case range, are both really important for people to mm-hmm. know. And so if it says on the sticker city, and for a car, it's, you know, 400 miles, if you're only going 25 miles an hour, I think that's instructive to people, even if that's not actually how they're going to use right. the car.
If the average person could understand confidence intervals, it would be a lot easier to communicate these things. I think you're absolutely right on that.
All right, let's move on to our next comment. At EVs of America, damn, we should have got that handle, says, this is about EV sound. Do EVs need sound inside the car? I'm an old school car enthusiast. I have owned performance cars since I drag raced my 1986 Buick Grand National back in 1986.
Hell yeah,
brother. I now own a 2017 Corvette Z06. I was drawn to EVs because of performance. I think the problem with performance EVs is the design. Ferrari is sexy. It's not a lightning bolt. It's not a cell phone. Sound is another downside to EVs. Most people want a silent EV, but I hear EVs on Pikes Peak and Formula E, and I think that's what a performance EV should sound like. The Lucid Air Sapphire is what a Ferrari should have been. Give me a mic by the electric motor and let me change the tone through speakers. I want my performance EV to sound like a witch on fire. So this guy says EVs need sound if they want to capture car enthusiasts. I'll read another one just because we got a similar comment that I think was also really funny. Bullet151 says, I equate engine noise to a cat's purr. If you could get a cat that was totally silent, it would still be cute, cuddly, and stress relieving. But to me, it would be missing something substantial. I don't care if it's fake. I don't care if nobody else can hear it but me. But there's an emotional connection for me that I will not willingly give up. The same with gears, but I can't think of a good analogy for that. Yeah, I also can't think of a cat analogy for gears.
I've started on all the other ones, so I want to hear your thoughts on this one first, because I'm taking up too much air.
I am not, like, I'm like the opposite of this EVs of America guy. Mm-hmm. I'm not a gas car enthusiast. I don't own a Z06. To me, I don't think that EVs need sound to be fun. But that's also coming from a guy who doesn't, like, I don't drive these cars super hard,
yeah.
But I really appreciate, I think one of the best parts of EVs is that they're quiet. And I think there have been many times when I'll get a press car and it has that spaceship drone-y noise inside. And when I turn it off. The artificialness of some of these sounds is actually really grating.
Yeah.
At the same time, it can be really fun, I think, if it's one of those cars that, which now there aren't that many of, but for example, in the Ioniq 5N, where it's one where you shift gears through the paddles,
mm-hmm.
having that noise, having one that's tuned well, it's not like grating on the ears, and that gives you those cues like revs to know when to shift, that
sure.
makes a lot of sense to me. I think for exotic cars, for performance cars, I do think it makes sense. Like if you want to sort of replicate that experience for people, there was this one that I drove a few years ago by a car company that I doubt anybody knows exists. It's the Pininfarina Battista.
Oh,
you know that one?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Mostly from them emailing me a bajillion times when it was new, but then never again. They kept showing up to auto shows with that thing.
Yeah, but this is like it's this multi-million dollar EV supercar. It's the same underneath as a Rimac Nevera, I think. It's a crazy, crazy high performance car underneath. And one of the sort of calling cards is the sound, and also the fact that it broadcasts sound outside and the mm-hmm. body vibrates. Like they have some sort of speakers that make the body panels just have that little bit of vibration that you feel if you like touched a gas car while the engine is running.
That's so weird.
And it was weird and it was a little gimmicky, but for something that's millions of dollars, that's really trying to do something and to replicate that super high performance, performance car thing. Mm-hmm. It was kind of cool. Like to do something like that you wouldn't get
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't think a Bolt needs that. So yeah, I think there's a line, but I think the sound can be good for these really sporty cars.
I have such conflicting emotions on this because I am a traditional sports car guy. I like a car that sounds good, unless it's driving past me and the guy's going fast. And then I'm like, oh my God, I hate that. And I was out for a hike out near Sunrise Highway in San Diego, for anyone who out there who knows it, but it's one of the best roads that I've ever driven, but it's also next to some really good hiking. And I was just hiking and I hear like a car come ripping by and making all this noise. And I was like, ah, oh, what a jerk. And I was like, man, I've been that jerk so many times driving by there, like GT3s and all these things that are just this beautiful, tranquil, you know, part of a national forest, just whatever. So I think it's definitely good that we're not going to do noises outside the car, except for Dodge, which I think has already been a failure. But I'm trying to get to the bottom of, I hear this a lot from comments like this where you talk about, oh, it's like a cat's purr, or that you just, you should have this feeling because that's right. It's what makes this emotional connection. And I'm trying to figure out, is that true, or is that a learned behavior? We have always associated us traditional car people, guy who's been racing since the 1980s, he's had a whole lifetime of being like, okay, this feeling I like of power, of speed, of the specialness of the machine, the connection, exists concurrent with this oral experience I'm getting. A-U-R-A-L, oral. just to be clear. But I didn't need to spell it. I made it worse than I spelled it. But anyway.
No, please explain. Go yeah. Dig yourself deeper here.
But I'm wondering, are those things inextricably linked? Or is that because we're all used to it? And I was sort of doing this thought experiment in my head. Let's say a 17-year-old who gets a Model 3 performance. He gets his dad's Model 3 performance in 2018, 2019. And that's the only fast car he's ever driven. And now he's been driving that for 6-7 years. Does that person think you need an audio connection? Now, he probably doesn't think you need it, but does he want it? And I think what's really interesting and maybe telling about this debate is the pure EV companies are pretty universally a hard no. They're just, like,
yeah.
I asked RJ if they would ever do that. And he was like, no, we do authentic things. We're not just going to like introduce this. But it's the Ferraris and the Hyundais that want to bring this in. And it's interesting, this comment mentions that you want to have this, the actual electric motor sound. But I think that's also a challenge because the gears and the sound really need each other to work. Because if you just have a spaceship noise and it goes, it needs to end. It needs to rise and fall. And if it's just one tone accelerating, most of what the cars that I've tested, the Mercedes CLA did this, my own Blazer EV, they kind of have a sound that comes on when you accelerate hard and just kind of quietly tapers off so that if you then let off and then go back on, you can hear it again. But so much of it is trying to create something out of nothing. And even if you magnify the sound of the electric motor, it is just a whir that just gets faster and faster and faster and faster. And that doesn't actually sound good. So I think in the short term, we're going to see a lot of experimentation here and to get cool things to happen. But I think in the long term, your car will either be completely silent or there will be one of these sort of spaceship noises that you can turn on and off connected to a drive mode. I don't think simulating gas cars has a lifespan beyond the next 5 or 10 years. And I also think it's helpful to think about the dawn of internal combustion cars when we're talking about this lens of, if you were used to racing horses and you're like, no, I want to hear the animal breathing. I want to feel the rise and fall of their lungs. I want...
Actually, the early Model T, it actually had a clomp clomp. You know, they just clomp clomp.
Ah, you stole my joke. I was going to get there. No, but but that's what I mean. Like, would you want like an early Model T to have some weird inflating bag that like rises and falls like the chest of a horse as you're running? Like, no, because this thing is fun in a different way. But in a Model T, the technology was not refined enough for you to get there. People did race Model Ts, but it was not as fun as racing a horse in the time because people hadn't figured out how to make it fun. And in the same way, I think a lot of the reasons that EVs are going to be fun when it comes to quad motor torque vectoring and instantaneous power and the ways you can game out different tunes and have a rad tuner like on Rivians where you can change all these different dynamics or you can change the power curve of your car in the future. There's so many ways you can make EVs infinitely more customizable and way faster and engaging that I think reaching back to the ways that gas cars were engaging, like, it's a dead end. It might be a useful dead end.
I think importantly, with the authenticity, right?
Right.
The ways you can make these EVs, you can play around the drive modes or whatever it is in a truly novel way.
Right.
Versus it's really hard to make the sound feel not like overly synthetic and sort of gross.
For sure.
And I think it's really, yeah.
There's also an area where I think they have already usurped gas cars as the most fun option, which is if you take an electric off-roader like a Rivian or a Mercedes G580 with EQ technology, insane name, off-roading, the fun is that it's silent and you can hear the birds and you can hear things crunching underneath you. You can actually hear when you lose traction very precisely and adjust to that. And then, you know, in a G-Class or a Rivian, you get to a big clearing and you can do 360s just for fun, or you can drive around a corner and have the back end kick out and slide automatically. Like, that's really fun. That is more fun than negotiating the exact same trail in a Raptor and all the other things a Raptor can do, jump through the air with these awesome, you know, shocks and stuff. We could solve that in EVs. And so I think already to me, there's proof that the EV experience can be more fun without the noise. We just need to bring it to the racetrack, which I think will happen.
Yeah, well said. All right, that is the episode. If you want to leave a question, drop a comment in the YouTube comments, send us an email at podcast@insideevs.com, leave a comment anywhere you listen to podcasts, and we will do this again sometime soon, and we will answer your questions. Thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday. Today's show was produced by Michael Perkins and brought to you by the Motorsport Network. Make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to the Inside EVs YouTube channel, and check out all our latest coverage on InsideEVs.com. See you next time.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.